All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome again to the Read Rothbard podcast. This is I think we said we weren't going to count them anymore. But we are 2 days behind schedule, especially after we said that we were going to do shorter yet more frequent podcasts, and we got the shorter bit down, but not the more frequent. How you doing, Robert?
You guys are a bunch of liars. I don't trust you at all. Bunch of bullshit.
You know, we're not being
pack of liars.
People.
How can we trust anything you guys say?
I know. Are you being our one or two listeners? Are you channeling?
I don't know what
them
I'm doing right now?
Right now.
I don't know. All I'm saying is that how dare you? Pack of liars. Or
yeah, I know. Well, I can say that we intend to do more and shorter episodes. However, we just had a pre-call, and it sounds like this one could be a long one.
Yeah, I don't really know. I don't have a whole lot of organization to my thoughts, so this could be a bit sprawling. But I'll talk about what I've been looking at lately and maybe kind of tie it into a movie that has had some ties to, at least has a somewhat kind of a liberty, anti-authority kind of a vibe to it, V for Vendetta.
Yeah, you know, I think of that one as one of the films like The Matrix that's pointed to in these circles that people recommend as, you know, hey, that's in line with my thinking or whatever.
Yeah, so V for Vendetta, it was a graphic novel by Alan Moore. And he's the same guy that did Watchmen. And I could be totally wrong on this. In fact, I should probably look it up. I'm not going to. There's no way to find out. He wrote back in the 80s that was basically a commentary on the Margaret Thatcher era of British politics. And then they, in like 2005, I want to say, something like that-ish, they made a movie by the Wachowskis. And they kind of changed it a bit. Took out the Margaret Thatcher kind of references and just made more of a totalitarian, authoritarian kind of a figurehead guy to be the main villain. But yeah, it's got some themes we could discuss, some implementations of the nap that we could talk about, and then there's a quote that we could really get going on that we'll talk about here in a little bit. But do you have any kind of like housekeeping or anything we could talk about beforehand?
Oh, man, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on, yet it seems like nothing ever gets done around here. Just like we keep promising to do more shows, and here we are. But I have been reaching out to some other like-minded folks and found a guy who's made a really cool animation out of an excerpt from Murray's what is it called? Anatomy of the State, where he talks about we are not the government and the government is not us. And this guy did some amazing animation to it and reached out to him. And we are talking about maybe working together on doing some animations of the treasure trove content that we have. And so I've posted that to our Facebook page and giving credit to him. And you guys should check it out. It's super good. I'll probably throw it on the Reed Rothbard site and maybe even up on our YouTube as well. I talked to him and he said that it's fine for us to share it around. Other than that, not a whole lot. At the moment, we did get a notice from Amazon saying that our affiliate links aren't getting as much love as they would like. So they're giving us 3 more months to get some more love going. So if anyone's listening and you know needs to like order some Swiffer refills or you know some toothpaste, go ahead and click through one of our links on our page and then find whatever you're going to buy, and that will keep us going on the Amazon thing.
Definitely, yeah. And I should probably do that too. I haven't had to buy anything on Amazon for a while, but just to keep it going, why not?
Yeah, now I will say that they frown upon the person named on the account doing it, so if I were to do it, it would be shut down.
Right, which is why I would need to do it. Or Hopefully one of our generous listeners.
Who needs to buy something anyway.
Yeah, people buy on Amazon all the time, and they're one of the best companies out there serving all kinds of needs. And they're getting into like the Netflix on-demand entertainment, and they're putting all kinds of great content, apparently.
Yeah, it's like a golden age of televised content. I mean, televised is a term loosely, but, you know, meant for consumption entertainment shows, just because there's such a wide variety of options, and you're not bound by what gets past certain networks or time, you know, like, oh, this is Thursday night, you know, lineup or whatever. Remember that used to be a big deal when we were growing up, like all the good shows were on Thursday night.
Yeah, the must-see TV on NBC or whatever.
Or TGIF, yeah. Thank goodness it's Friday, or thank God it's Friday. There's like Family Matters with Steve Urkel.
Oh, yeah. And I don't know how much of this content that Netflix and Amazon and iTunes and all these people that are producing is governed or is under the thumb of like the FCC. I'm sure that they are working towards doing that, but it seems to be right now that they're essentially getting away with whatever. Because, you know, if a broadcaster on a national network television says anything like on the unapproved word list or whatever, the FCC will step in and fine them like thousands and thousands of dollars, just extorting them for money.
Yeah, or they get taken off the air.
Yeah.
Two recent examples are Billy Bush, who was in that video with Donald Trump recently that caused this uproar.
It was like 11 years ago or something, or 9 years ago?
Yeah, 11 years ago when he was doing Access Hollywood, and now he's on the Today Show. But once this video leaked, he got removed from the Today Show.
Right, as if what you said on a TV show 11 years ago is indicative of whatever. Even if you are of the opinion that, yes, people should be removed of their livelihood for saying a thing. Now, as a private thing, as a private company, you know, if you got somebody on your show that you don't like what they're saying, sure, get rid of them. But it's kind of ridiculous to say, well, this is a thing you said 11 years ago, and we don't like what you said 11 years ago, so we're going to get rid of you.
It's like, I agree with you, like, it is a private matter. You know, it's an employer-employee relationship, and so they should be able to do whatever they want pursuant to not violating the non-aggression principle or fraudulently doing anything. But it's just kind of funny to see, you know, point out that these other venues can get away with a lot more stuff, and yet, you know, when you're actually still tied to a network, this dinosaur model, similar to how newspapers are dying off, you know, I think television networks are going to be struggling ever more in the near future. But another recent example was Dr. Oz had a or no, not Dr. Oz, Dr. Drew. Dr. Drew Pinsky, he had a show on, was it OLN or one of those cable TV shows?
Like, is that the Dr. Love, the Love? Didn't have
yeah,
like
it was with
Love.
Adam Carolla way back in the day, the Dr. Drew show.
Yeah, yeah, that was the
Love Line, maybe?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, so then he's you know been doing more and more stuff over the years, and more recently he's had a show on a cable network, and he was doing a radio interview with somebody like a month ago, and he was talking about the signs of Parkinson's in Hillary Clinton. Like he was you know looking at some tape of her and being like, yeah, this is in line with this and this is in line with that, and it's kind of weird. The level of care she seems to be getting is like from 1950, you know, kind of giving his you know, doctory opinion on this matter. And a couple of days later, his show gets canceled. Now, again, private situation, you know, if they don't like what he's saying, that's fine, but it's just kind of a hypocritical thing in a way. It seems to be anyway.
Oh, the war on free speech is absolutely fully in effect. There was like a teacher down in, I want to say like South Carolina, and I don't have it in front of me, and I'm not going to look it up. And he made a statement about Black Lives Matter, saying, I forget exactly what he said. He compared them to the Ku Klux Klan. And regardless of whether you agree with that statement or not, there were all kinds of the university, like, came out and condemned him. And I think that they were talking about firing, or they did fire him. Maybe they didn't fire him, or they put him on leave. And there's this huge backlash. And it, the all these statements and student groups saying that he should be fired and that this speech is offensive to us and, you know, we shouldn't have to hear this kind of thing, especially from whatever, our teachers or whatever. Like, you're supporting his speech if you employ him or what have you. It just, that's going on across all over the universities, all over the country, that, you know, this is speech we don't tolerate. We don't celebrate free speech. It's more of a, we tolerate speech that we enjoy, and we support free speech as long as we agree with it. It's interesting. And sad.
Yeah, it's like if it's not that publicly approved political opinion, then it's hate speech and therefore should be illegal. Like, bringing it back to that Trump thing, I posted a screenshot to you where somebody was saying that we should ban locker room speech or locker room conversations. Like,
yeah,
how the
that?
Fuck are you going to do that?
on
what level?
I just, that's just hilarious.
Remotely,
okay. I would love to get into a casual conversation where I pretended to agree with that person, and then we were actually like, yeah, let's ban locker room conversations. How are we going to do that? Let's hire people to patrol locker rooms and stick guns in people's faces whenever you hear any kind of untoward comment, and have this kind of, you know, thought police, this go out and can you imagine trying to implement such a horrific policy, let alone just the morality of it in general?
Right, yeah. And then that teacher in North Carolina who's saying, you know, there's a likeness to BLM and the KKK. I mean, he's not wrong on certain levels, in my opinion. You know, like, they're talking about making decisions based on race and, you know, certain things need to be done to promote that idea, you know, this racial superiority or whatever. And it seems like anything that's pro Black Lives Matter is totally legit and okay, even though, from what I can see, they seem to be the ones instigating riots and violence.
Well, and there's also a massive hypocrisy in that there are all kinds of, I guess, you could have a student group that are like for like Black Power, like Black promoting the Black race, whatever. But as soon as you have, I guess there was like a student who wanted to start a white power and supporting the white race group, and he was instantly, you know, condemned. It's like, well, there's a disconnect there. But that goes along with the, I've seen a bunch of YouTube videos recently that are going along saying, well, you can't be racist if you are oppressed, and you can't be racist if you are Black or a minority. You can only be racist if you also have the upper hand, you have like the privilege or what have you. It goes along with, there's this also one lady who said all interracial relationships are rape because that involve like a white person and like a Black person or a white person and a person of color, because the white person has a superiority or like some sort of a societal privilege of some kind or dominance. And since, you know, the other person is oppressed somehow, some way, that it's a difference in power in the relationship, and therefore that since you're constantly, you, the one with power would always be raping the one without the power,
even if it's voluntary. Because
even if it's voluntary.
Voluntary,
no, even if it's voluntary. I think Anarchy Ball did a video on it, and he says that I think it's the Black Hitler says some crazy shit video. You'll have to check it out. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's just crazy the leaps of logic that these SJWs have to go to twist things so that they, I don't know, have something to bitch about, you know? It's just so bizarre. Like an example, personally, is my wife is in this baby-wearing group on Facebook or whatever, and the other day she saw someone post, hey, to all my, like, Chicana baby-wearing mamas out there, happy whatever day. And Jamie's like, what the fuck? Like, if I were to say, hey, happy White Power Day, you know, I'd be shut down and banned, like, immediately. But they can say all this, you know, Hispanic this, Hispanic Black Power, whatever.
Yep. Brown Pride.
Babywares of color, like, yeah. Anyway, it was just bizarre. It's like, just because you're white, you're evil and bad, and even more so for us because we're men, you know. And at what point are we then the oppressed one? You know, how much further does it need to go before we are the oppressed ones, and therefore we can say that we are the ones who are the victims and we're on the other side of the oppression and we can't be racist because we're being oppressed?
Right. It's always this massively vague thing. They're always saying, you know, this whole bullshit oppression crap There are places in the world where there really is oppression. There are places where you can't go outside without wearing, you know, whatever. You can't be covered up and you can't drive and all this bullshit. But then they kind of equate, like, a man saying a thing or the fact that white people exist as that you are somehow oppressed. It's kind of hilarious. If anything, minority groups are often, and I'm not talking like Asians predominantly, apparently they're doing fairly well, but people of Hispanic and African-American type descent are oftentimes like the receivers of welfare, which in my view is a bad thing. I mean, it's not only a bad thing for them, it's a bad thing for everybody involved. But you could say that is a kind of a benefit almost. Like, I don't understand where this idea of oppression comes from. Like, I know the wage grab bullshit argument, which, I mean, why would anybody ever hire a man if the wage gap is a real thing? If you could hire a woman for 73 cents on the dollar, why would anybody ever hire a man to do anything? It doesn't make any sense. So I don't understand how women are somehow being oppressed. It's always this vague thing, and it's never spoken in specific terms. And it's almost always done collectively.
Yeah, that's what people who have this line of thinking, they always say it's society or the group or whatever that's more important or meaningful over the individual, when the reality is only individuals exist. And so in a way, it's sort of like being able to scapegoat on this nameless, faceless thing that doesn't actually exist. And then it's this never-ending, never-solvable thing. So they always have this thing to complain about if they're in a position of having employment as a result of it. They have, you know, this job security, because the problem will never be solved in their mind because it's not a problem that actually exists.
Right. If you complain about phantom things, you can complain about phantom things forever. So yeah, it seems to be, it's like, it's always just playing the victim. Like, we're oppressed. I'm a minority, so I'm therefore oppressed, and I'm a victim. Therefore, I can totally discount anything you say and call you a racist or a bigot or whatever because you disagree with me.
And it does seem to be the go-to response when you do challenge them with actual arguments or facts or logic. They immediately jump to either you're a racist or a homophobe or a bigot, or you're wrong because you're a white man.
Yeah. And how long?
That's why Milo's so great, because, yeah, he's a white man, but he's also very articulate, and he's gay and very, you know, open and flamboyant about it and really in the SJW's face. And I just enjoy him on that level.
Yeah, I mean, he's a terrible statist, but yeah, on the SJW front, he said some great things. Anyway.
I'm not sure what this has to do with Vias for Vendetta yet, but you did talk a little bit about it. Maybe we can sort of wind our way back to that.
Well, let's just jumping over to the topic. I'm sure we could have an entire discussion on what we were just talking about, but let's talk about V for Vendetta. So, like I said in the intro, it's produced by the Wachowskis, starring a lot of your Matrix alums, or at least one Matrix alum. Agent Smith plays V, and Natalie Portman plays the main female character, and I don't remember her name. But the main story is that, you know, like 20 years ago or what have you, I forget the timeline, they had this false flag kind of terror attack to gain power. It was like this, they released a bioweapon, and a whole bunch of people died. And out of the chaos of that arose this kind of dictator-type guy. And V was a guy who was originally tortured and kidnapped and experimented upon. And he was like the one success of this program to kind of make like super soldier. And it left him like horribly scarred, and like he doesn't have eyeballs and totally brutally scarred all over his body. And the story takes up where he is getting his revenge on all the people that attacked him back in the day. So he goes around and he kills this government agent and this doctor, and he ultimately wants to kill the prime minister guy, this dictator dude. And in doing so, he kind of adopts this Natalie Portman character whose parents were also murdered by this government's brutal regime. They were kind of like protester type people, and they were brutally murdered or disappeared. And so she lost them. And so she's like this kind of this orphan person. So she kind of goes under his wing and kind of agrees with him and kind of helps him a little bit. And from our perspective, I don't know if you can really justify what he does. He is basically on this revenge game where he's just going to murder these people because of something they did years ago. Now, he is killing people who are actively aggressing against people constantly. So the same argument of, you know, are you justified in killing cops or a government agent or anybody that is actively stealing from people or attacking people? It happens to fall in line with him getting revenge for this brutal treatment that he received. But I don't think you can, at least I don't think you can really justify his murder revenge plot. And then he's also, his main plot is to blow up Parliament with like this subway car full of explosives, which he actually does. And the movie doesn't, I think the movie shows that there was nobody in the Parliament at the time, so he's not like murdering a whole bunch of people because it happens at like midnight or something like that.
So just the janitors.
Probably just the janitors, those evil janitors. So before we get into the quote that I want to like depart on, do you have any comments about the application of the NAP and V's actions vis-a-vis his treatment versus the current day of him murdering these people that harmed him in the past that are currently hurting people, but not directly? They're essentially bad advice givers that work in government and tell people to, you know, aggress against people.
Well, it is kind of a tough one. It reminds me of the, you know, do you go back in time and kill Hitler? And if so, is Duarte, that's the guy's name, right, in the Philippines, they're likening him to being a modern-day Hitler who just hasn't gone out.
He likened that to himself.
Yet. Oh, right.
He compared that to himself. He was like saying, I'm going to kill all these drug dealers and drug users, and I'm going to exterminate people just like Hitler killed the Jews.
Yeah, so it seems like he definitely has made direct and imminent threats towards an entire classification of people. So I wonder if, you know, in the standard lines of self-defense, if there'd be an argument to say any one of those people could make an effort to stop him and be justified in doing so.
Yeah. Yeah, if you were a drug user in the Philippines right now, or is it Manila? Is it the Philippines? Or is it Indonesia? I forget. I think it's the Philippines. I could be wrong.
I think it's the Philippines.
Yeah, so if you happen to be taking, you've got some marijuana and you're in the Philippines right now, you are a targeted person. You've got a bullseye on your back. Are you justified in killing this guy? It seems like you are. Although he is essentially a bad advice giver. He is somebody who is telling other people to commit violent acts. Now, he is threatening them with violent acts to, you know, he's coercing people who work in the government to attack people. So he is essentially a threatener. I don't know if he's essentially just a bad advice giver.
Doesn't the morality kind of go out the window once there's coercion involved? Like, you can't judge the morality of the person who's being threatened to do something or else.
Right, so yeah, a command from Duarte, I guess, wouldn't just be advice, because he's saying, you, my cop enforcer thug guy, you have to go do this. But he's not saying, you have to go do this, or else I'm going to put you in jail. He's saying, you have to do this, or you're fired.
Or you won't get paid. So
right.
It's like hiring a hitman. And don't you think that hiring a hitman, the person who did the hiring, would ultimately be responsible, but also the hitman himself would be the individual who also bears some responsibility as well?
I would say the hitman is the ultimate responsibility. But in the traditional argument is to say that, yeah, the initiator is also bears some responsibility, even though I think that they're essentially an advice giver, because you're offering in exchange value, like some money, to a hitman. You're not threatening that hitman with anything. You're just offering them money if they go and do it.
But you certainly put the chain of events in motion, and you make the outcome that you wish very clear. You know, you're hiring them to do a specific job that involves the initiation of violence against someone else, and granted, you're giving them the voluntary option to do it or not. I don't know. I still think that the ultimate responsibility doesn't only lie on the hitman himself or herself. You know, because they don't want to be sexist. Like, women can be hitmen too, right? Hit person.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I tend to fall more on the burden more lies with the actual gun trigger puller if there's no coercion involved. But I would definitely say it's a despicable act. I don't know if you hire somebody to kill somebody, I would say that the person that actually pulls the trigger is the one guilty of murder. I don't know what you would say that the person who hired the person is guilty of, but I wouldn't say it's murder.
All right.
Even
then
though,
let's
even
change
though
it
the ultimate
just a
effect,
little bit.
Even though the ultimate effect is a dead person, and that it all began with the person who hired.
All right. So how about if I change it slightly and say, you've got a restaurant, and the chef makes some bad food and people get sick. Is it mm-hmm. only the chef, or is the responsibility also tied to the owner of the restaurant? After all, they maintain the equipment, the cleanliness, the hiring, the staffing, the quality of the food. So is it just the chef who, you know, made the bad food? Or
in that situation, I would say that the responsibility lies upon, yeah, more on the owner. Absolutely. But
right.
I wouldn't say that the same situation applies directly.
Oh, okay. Because, yeah, you're right. It is a bit different.
Anyway, so we're getting way off here.
Way off topic.
So let me just ask you flat out then. I know this is a complicated issue and what have you, but would you say that V's actions are defensible?
I think he could make an argument, yes. After all, he was tortured by these people, and who are we to say what is proper compensation or recompense for the harms done to him, you know, and in mm-hmm. a free society, there's no like statute of limitations on, you know, when something terrible has been done to you and what compensation or, you know, other consequences to the perpetrator should be. Like, I
right.
don't know how that would all play out in a free society, but I can't condemn him.
Mm-hmm. All right, then. Let's move on to a quote in the movie that V gives. So Natalie Portman's character has been brought back to V's kind of like home, and he's got all these nice things. Like, I mean, this place just looks like a medieval castle, kind of. It's got just looks like valuable art all over the room and whatnot. And at one point, Natalie makes the point, like, you know, where did you get all this stuff? He's like, well, I, you know, appropriated it from, like, you know, a government caravan or what have you. And she's like, you stole it. And V goes, theft implies ownership. So it kind of leads us into the whole idea of, like, that Robin Hood idea of, you know, are you taking it? He's not actually giving it back to the original people it was stolen from. He is taking it for himself. I don't know how easy it would be to return. Maybe. I mean, you could probably put an ad and say, hey, I found this thing.
Bunch of stolen goods here.
A bunch of stolen goods here. I don't know. Did anybody lose some stuff? Did they have some stuff stolen from them? If those people are even alive anymore or what have you, it might be difficult to return it to them. But, yeah, is it justified to liberate, to take from government things they clearly don't own, things that are clearly stolen, and take them for yourself in, say, maybe recompense for your own stolen money? Maybe you actually haven't had things stolen from you, but you've certainly had money stolen from you. Is that legitimate?
Yeah, that's another tough one, because if it was an individual basis and you found out that someone had taken something of yours and you saw it there and you had the opportunity to get it back, I think you'd have every right to do so. But somehow, just by changing the name of the individual or group of individuals into something called government, all of a sudden it muddies the waters. And it's that language trick, that Orwellian, you know, let's not call it theft, let's call it taxation, let's not call it this, let's call it that, and all of a sudden that changes the morality of it. You know, you change the name of the group of people who does it, or call the action something different. And so I think that in today's world, not in the Libertopia, Libertarianistan, or Ancapistan, I think is what they would call it, where we're actually in a free society, there wouldn't be a government to take things from you, so it would be looked at as more of the individual basis. But in today's world, I think you'd be morally justified in doing so, but I don't think that the consequences of acting on that moral high ground that you actually have would result in anything positive for you.
Right. So this also kind of brings up the idea. Also, I was looking at recently Larkin Rose posted some good Steam stuff, and he's going through a series on, I don't know what his series is called, but it's just called a series. I don't know.
It's related to like property and
so yeah, the second
collective ownership.
The second post. Well, let's see here. The first post was called Capitalism, Good or Bad. And he talks about what the definitions of capitalism are and how oftentimes people will be arguing against straw men, where one guy's definition of capitalism is, you know, voluntary exchange, and another guy's definition of anarchism or capitalism is corporatocracy, blah, blah, blah. So he kind of breaks that down. And the second part was collective versus private ownership. And he talks about what property is, how property is essentially the ultimate right to decide what to do with a thing. So if I own a sandwich, it's my choice if I'm going to eat that sandwich, if I'm going to cut it up and give it to other people, if I'm going to throw it on the ground, if I'm going to light it on fire, whatever.
Happy sandwich to the ground.
Because I'm an adult. I can choose what I want with my sandwich. And how under the idea of collective ownership, it totally makes a mess of the situation where you don't know who ultimately has the decision of what to do with a thing. If everybody owns a chair, who has the right to sit in that chair? Who ultimately decides who can destroy that chair or do whatever, give up that chair, whatever. Anyway. So the quote in V for Vendetta of, you know, theft implies ownership, the anarcho-communist view of nobody really owns property or that property is theft, like it breaks down really badly because in order to have theft, you're implying that there is such a thing as property.
Otherwise, how could it be stolen?
Right. Otherwise, not going to be stolen.
Yeah, if it's not owned, then what does stealing it actually mean? And if property is theft, yet property doesn't exist, it doesn't make any sense. And yet, on the other level, they're exercising property over their own selves by being able to say it. You know, using the words that they choose on an individual basis to orate to you in their
right, using their own bodies, which is why they distinguish between personal property and then private property. And yet that's always super muddy. It's like the things you use on a daily basis are somehow personal property. But anything that qualifies
okay.
as the means of production.
Toothbrushes are like, okay, and a personal hatchet to like cut your own firewood is okay. But as soon as you cut some firewood to sell to someone else, it's not okay.
Right. And how is your body not part of the means of production? How are your clothing not a part of the means of production? It doesn't make any sense. And they'll say,
they claim that labor is the only thing that even provides value to anything. So, you know, if the means of production doesn't involve self-ownership, yet labor is the only thing that gives value to any good, isn't that also a self-defeating argument?
Yeah, it breaks down really badly. So anyway, Larkin wrote this article, and he talked about how, you know, ownership, and reading the article, I'm like, okay, I know that there's going to be some bad ANCOM response to the article at the bottom in the comments. And I was not disappointed.
Just anticipating.
I knew I was getting towards the end, I was like, oh, I can't wait for the terrible ANCOM rebuttal. So there's this guy named Freeborn Angel. He comments, and he claims, he goes, okay, Larkin, I'm starting to think that you're serving the oligarchs too. And he links this, a link to an Emma Goldman article called There's No Communism in Russia. So there's a distinction between ANCOMs. They seem to be the ANCOMs that think that Marxism is communism, and those that think it isn't. There's a guy on YouTube named like Jason Uruhe, I want to say is how you pronounce that guy's name. I don't know, Ure, something like that. And he makes all these videos about how North Korea is super cool and how Mao really didn't kill all those people and just how communism is just the cat's meow and it's all this capitalist propaganda and how capitalism actually causes all these mental disorders and how it's just the worst. How voluntary exchange is just the worst. And I would say that he suffers from the same talking about different things and that Larkin is talking about. Like his definition of capitalism is, you know, basically corporatocracy and that sort of thing. But I don't know. Anyway, so there's these ANCOMs that think that Marxism is cool, and then there are ANCOMs that think that no, Marx had it wrong. He was part of this oligarch where there's this authority, this level of hierarchy. So he's
all
saying
that they want to break down all levels of hierarchy.
Right, even voluntary ones, because somehow you're oppressing somebody by giving them a job. So this Freeborn Angel guy, he posts this book by Peter Kropotkin called The Conquest of Bread, and he says, as an anarchist, you are well aware of the above book. If you're not, then please stop referring to yourself as an anarchist because you're clearly something else. So he's calling out this Peter Kropotkin book as the end-all, be-all, ultimate Bible of anarchy.
Appeal to authority.
Where there's no authority, there's no hierarchy, right? This is perfectly no hierarchy.
He just appealed to authority, and the authority said there's no authority? That is fucking blowing my mind.
Okay, stop destroying his arguments right off the bat. We got to get to it. So in this book, which he links to, and I pulled up the link, and he's saying, you know, he's calling this book out as the Bible of anarchy. Like, you have to know this book, and this perfectly lays it out, right? Where it lays out no hierarchy. And so I'm reading along, and I linked a few things that were just ridiculous. But in the so here's a section on clothing, and he's already talked about food and housing. And here's a direct quote. The question of clothing will, of course, demand consideration next. And again, the only possible solution will be to take possession. So he's declaring that ownership is a thing and that a certain group of people need to take possession. And he says here, the only possible solution will be to take possession in the name of the people and of all the shops and warehouses where clothing is sold or stored and to throw open the doors to all so that each can take what he needs. So just in that one, and he repeats himself throughout the whole book. I haven't read the whole book, but I've read, you know, basically the first paragraph of many of these sections. And
bad comrade, you got to read the whole thing.
I know. But he keeps saying that, you know, we need to take possession of everything in the name of the people. Well, he's creating a government. He's creating an authority right there. He's creating this super organization that owns everything. So how is that not hierarchy?
Right, plus they're taking it from someone, so they're assuming control over or hierarchy over someone else or another group of people.
Right, and my comment to you initially was the ridiculousness of this guy where he's saying that, well, we can just take all these coats because, you know, go down to the store and look at all these coats. Look, there's plenty for everybody. Come on, what are you talking about? Look, at there's so much extra. There's so much plenty. So just throw open your doors and just take what you need from all this plenty. As if communism is what created this plenty to begin with. He doesn't recognize, or in fact, he completely fails to acknowledge that what provided all that plenty was capitalism, was the idea that those people created that thing, all those coats, out of a desire to get something in return, out of a desire to receive value for those coats. They wouldn't create all those coats if they were just subject to being stolen.
Right.
The whole idea,
that was all just built up capital value. Like that was all produced goods that were to be sold, you know, so they're not actually like personal property just yet. They're still like means of production. They're still within that chain of goods, you know, like from the raw materials through manufacture through warehousing and retail. Like
right.
They're not
and
finished and delivered goods yet.
And that chain of goods is dependent upon those sales to maintain it. As soon as all those coats are stolen, well, how quickly does that chain break down?
Right, yeah, where are more coats going to come from? Where is coats tomorrow or next year going to come from?
Exactly. So my comment to you
the
was...
biblical argument, the, you know, you teach the guy to fish, or you give him a fish, and he eats the fish, and then he's fucked.
Right, so my argument was, you know, this stupid asshole wants to keep sucking off the teat of capitalism, but yet after they've killed the cow, you destroy any incentive for anybody to make a coat, and all of a sudden there's not going to be a coat. So he goes over some of the criticism, and he says one of the criticisms is that there won't be enough coats because everybody will want the finest coat. He says, everyone will want a sable-lined coat or a velvet gown, exclaim our adversaries. And he says, frankly, we do not believe it. Every woman does not dote on velvet, nor does every man dream of sable linings. So his response to people saying that everybody would choose the highest quality thing, if everybody was given a choice of coats, they're going to pick the highest quality coat. And his response is, yeah, but everybody doesn't have the same fashion sense. Okay. That doesn't respond to the criticism at all. We're not saying that everybody doesn't have a different fashion sense. We're saying that we're given the choice of a high-quality coat and a threadbare piece of shit coat. People are going to pick the highest quality coat with no cost involved. There's no cost to you. So you're going to pick the best quality thing available. And he's saying that we're saying that, yeah, you would quickly run out. Without prices, which are what are available in free markets, prices are just convey information, and they allow efficient decisions to be made. Without prices, you're just going to pick the highest quality thing. And then, oh, no, all of a sudden there's a shortage in high-quality coats. Surprise, surprise.
Well, not only that, but the types of things available once you remove prices would be garbage anyway. Like, it wouldn't be high quality. It would be, like, minimum viable, not even viable. It'd just be like, your quota, 5,000 tons of coats. So then you make all these coats out of concrete or some bullshit.
Right, you got these plastic coats that are just total horseshit. Like, there you go, there's your 5,000 coats, and there's enough for everybody, a coat for everybody. Never mind that, yeah, you're right, they would just be the shittiest base amount to fulfill the quota. So, I mean, you could probably read
calculate.
This whole book.
They can't calculate.
No, they can't do any of the price calculation. They can't. And it doesn't, they suffer from the motivation problem. And the motivation problem is a real huge fucking problem. It's when people say that communism works on paper, no, it doesn't. It doesn't even come close. It doesn't work in theory at all because it doesn't solve the motivation problem. People do things because they expect to be compensated in return, because everybody is choosing, everybody has goals. Everybody has things that they want in life. And
all
they
right,
have to provide
Robert,
value to get value. Hmm?
Aren't these the same people bitching and moaning about wage theft and not being paid enough and how the minimum wage needs to be higher?
Yeah. Pretty much.
So doesn't that, like, not add up? You know? Like, free exchange
well,
of staff. Communism's great and amazing, but we want more money. But we want to abolish money.
Well, in Larkin's point, yeah, he was talking about his latest post. He actually posted just a few hours ago where he talks about it's called Money, Good or Bad. And it seems like people that want to get rid of money and think that that's, like, the evil of all, you know, the root of all evil. It's like if they could just get rid of money, then what are you left with to get what you want? You can either barter for it or you can, like, violently appropriate it from somebody.
Well, yeah, that's like the Dan Cunha speech in Atlas.
Right. You can have money or you can have a gun. It's,
or if you're in government, you can have both.
Right. It's saying that you're being oppressed by money or the need to have to work for anything. As if, and Larkin makes this point, as if you were just out in the middle of nowhere in the forest somewhere, as if you wouldn't have to actually work to survive, as if nature isn't suppressing, you know, oppressing you, as if...
All right, yeah, that's the Peter Joseph thing, right? Where he's saying that because people had to work, they're being oppressed, as if in a state of nature, milkshakes would just rain down from the heavens and you wouldn't have to work at all to even consume it. It would just magically nourish you.
Yeah, because scarcity is somehow oppressing you. It's really bad. I highly recommend Larkin's series on Steemit. It's steemit.com. If people aren't checking that out, he's been posting a lot of really good stuff lately.
Yeah, spell that out, because it's not like traditional steam, right? It's like a steam.
Yeah, it is steemit.com. And you could just, you could search, you know, Steemit, Larkin Rose.
Or look at the link down below right next to the Amazon affiliate link that if somebody clicks on and buys toothpaste or a 50-inch plasma TV or whatever, we'll keep our account open.
Yeah, buddy.
Throw a little plug in there. Capitalism, baby.
That's right. So he debunked that really well. And there aren't a whole lot of dumb comments yet, but I assume it's only been out like a couple hours, so wait for it. I also highly recommend looking at this collective versus private ownership, the part two in the series, and then going down and reading the Freeborn Angel comments. And he goes back and forth quite a bit. Freeborn Angel does. And I think his comments are really bad, but decide for yourself if you think they're any good.
Yeah, and if you guys do read that, and feel free to jump in the fray and comment directly to him, or I'll open up comments down below this podcast, and you guys can comment. Let us know what you think, because we'd be interested.
Yeah, because I don't understand the. I mean, there seems to be a divide in the ANCOM argument, and I disagree with all ANCOMs. If you want to form some kind of commune where you're going to go out and live, fantastic. As long as you're not aggressing against anybody and it's all voluntary, fine. But you are going against a fundamental human desire. Even if you don't think even if you don't think it applies to you, you're going against the desire to obtain goals, and I'm not really saying this very well.
Achieve things, get rewards, work hard.
Yeah, to receive see the benefit of your labor, to be compensated for the return on your labor. I know the desire of, a common complaint of working in a capitalist system is that you are working for a capitalist, they call them, really just the business owner, the entrepreneur, but that you're being unfairly compensated for your labor, even though it's completely voluntary, and that somehow you are then a wage slave, and it is unfair, and that you want to see the full return on your labor and be fully and justly compensated, right? That's like a common refrain, like workers unite, we need to get fully compensated for our labor. Well, if you go and live in a commune, you're going to receive zero of what you return. You're going to get like the base minimum. You're not going to be compensated at all. And in fact, it's going to encourage you to be lazy, because anything you have, anything you create, is subject to being confiscated by the collective, because you don't have any greater claim to it. No matter how much effort you put into making a thing, you don't have any greater claim to it than anybody else does.
So you spend Unless you can weeks. Demonstrate greater need.
How do you do that?
I don't know, but that's what they say, right? Each according to their need. So it'd be whoever can demonstrate the most need or be the biggest victim. I think in a way we kind of already live in a one giant commune. When you talk about wage slavery and people wanting to see the full benefit of their labor, and these ANCOMs, they want to get paid more, like $15 an hour as the new minimum wage, and labor is the only thing
right.
that provides value to any good, and working for the man is slavery, yet they're also the ones who advocate for more taxation. And so on what level is they want more of what they earn, because they think they should earn more, yet they're perfectly okay with 30 to 40% of it being stolen in order to achieve that. So isn't that sort of another self-defeating thing? Or are they saying that we need to earn more because we want so much stolen from our paycheck, and somehow that's not slavery? And that reminds me of that Nozick thing I sent you.
Well, I think we might be conflating socialists with ANCOMs a little bit here. I've seen many ANCOM posts that are like, no, government's terrible, taxation is theft, get rid of the state.
Oh, okay.
So we could make that distinction, but you're right about socialists and most people, like especially on the left, but also on the right. They also advocate for taxation on the right too.
You're all a bunch of socialists, to quote the great Mises.
You are. Yeah, Mises says it. But yeah, so they are absolutely advocate for higher wages, but yet they also advocate for higher taxes. So yeah, it doesn't make any sense. One last thought on, well, it's actually Larkin makes the point. When you have a situation in a collectivistic society where nobody owns anything, you don't understand who has the final say on what to be done with a given thing, whether that be a sandwich or a car or whatever.
Or a forest or some natural resources or anything, right?
Yeah, when nothing is owned, apparently it's all owned and nobody owns it, it will usually end in violence. This is the point Larkin makes, and I don't know if we could dispute this or not, because it seems to be true to me. A situation in which no one has the final say will usually lead to violence. Whoever can take control of something by force wins, because no one recognizes anyone else as having any special claim. This is why respect for private property is essential to a peaceful society. This is the claim Larkin makes, and I can't really find any holes in it. It seems to be true that the person who puts the most effort into a thing, you make that sandwich, you seem to have the best claim to that sandwich. I mean, who else? I don't care if someone comes along and they're starving. How do they have a better claim to that sandwich?
Right. In a free society, if it's your sandwich, you can decide on your own volition whether you want to donate it to that starving person or not.
Absolutely.
And most people probably would. I mean, the whole argument for welfare being okay is that people think that as a group, we've all decided together to take taxes and give to the less fortunate because people on an individual basis would be too greedy to do it, yet they don't seem to understand that people didn't have money stolen from them, and if the majority of people voted for these things to happen to begin with, and if they didn't think it was already being taken care of, I think that you would see an increase in the amount of giving and voluntary benefits to people who are struggling and need some help.
Yeah, and Larkin makes that point. He makes that point in where there is great wealth created through the free market by being able to maintain your own things and see the benefit, the full benefit of your labor. There is a great amount of charity because it leads to so much wealth.
Yeah, an ancillary point to the ownership question is not only the collective ownership, which really means nobody owns it, versus individual ownership, is the capital value. Like if nobody owns the lake, or the fish in the lake, or in the seas, or in the stream, or the forest in the trees, or the gold in the mine, or anything, no one owns that. There's no incentive to maintain that structure, to maintain the output so that it'll be worth something going forward in time. You know what I'm saying? Like, why not get all the fish right now?
Why not strip mine it? Why not totally kill all the buffalo? You got to get what you can while it's still there.
Right, yeah. Why not, be the Lorax and cut down all the trees, because nobody owns
putting
that
yourself
forest
out of business.
Yeah.
So
but
dumb.
Somebody owned it.
Sorry, that movie's so dumb. They cut down all the trees, and now they don't have any trees to harvest for their business. Totally ignoring the idea that their business runs on trees. So stupid. As if they wouldn't know that. They wouldn't know that their business runs on trees? Wow, that's incredible.
Right, yeah. But my point is that people who own something have a vested interest in maintaining the value of it and, utilizing it in the meantime at the appropriate market-driven amounts,
They have the best claim, yes. That's the most interest to maintain that resource, to get value out of it for now and in the future, absolutely.
Right, and yet you see all these, endangered species and damaged landscape and all these things from all these unowned resources, or like the government, quote-unquote, owns it and then leases out the rights to, cut down the trees or do whatever or give you a license for how many fish you can get. All it does is incentivize people to go out and basically get as much out of that resource as possible, and they don't give a shit about what's left afterward because they don't own it. They're renting it or leasing it or just buying the rights to, do one thing to it. And once they're done, it's out of sight, out of mind, It's not their problem anymore.
And that's an excellent point. And then the company gets the blame for the situation set up by government, who is apparently immune to any criticism on that. Because, absolutely, the government sets it up. They claimed ownership over this area, even though they haven't homesteaded shit. And then, they lease it out, sell it out, whatever. They lease it. Well, they don't sell it, but they lease it out, like you say, to a company who's just going to try and get the most value out of that deal as possible. And they don't have a vested interest in, maintaining that land. So they're going to, absolutely strip it for all it's worth because they want to get the most value on their investment. And then they get all the
blame. They're set up to fail. It's set up to destroy that whole apparatus. And it stems from not allowing rightful ownership in private hands. Or individual.
Tragedy of the commons, absolutely. And, the ANCOMs don't have an answer for this criticism. I haven't found one.
Well, I think their argument is that everyone would just be so in tune with nature that they would know when this many fish is too many or that many trees is too many, or they want to go back to the state of nature, like before Columbus was here, you know, where the Indians roamed the land, and that was the optimum amount of trees. But, you know, then we wouldn't be here. And, you know, the other thing that's funny is all these people complain on the internet, on their iPhones or on their laptops, complaining about how evil free market things are, which is disingenuous, to say the least.
Right.
I mean, shouldn't they be living in huts that they built out of their own hands and using stone tools and sending smoke signals to complain about shit?
They should be, if they were consistent. But they decry greed when greed serves them everywhere, constantly.
Well,
they're
aren't they surrounded
in people who have, out of greed or desire to service their own interests, provided all this value to them to make a computer for them, not for some altruistic purpose. They didn't build a computer so that you would be able to get on the internet and blah, blah, blah. They built that computer out of expect of exchanging it for money in return to satisfy their greed. But yet the word greed gets demonized, and it's often associated with corporatocracy and instances with government and how government puts a cap on greed. And it's always fighting greed. It's the good fight when greed actually services mankind, is the engine of the economy.
Yeah, I think it's a corruption of words because when government wants, you know, 40% of your income,
it's not
an ever-increasing amount. Somehow that's not greedy.
Right.
It's just such a bizarre thing. And I wanted to bring up this point earlier when you were talking about Marxism and they were complaining about corporatocracy versus actual capitalism. Das Kapital was actually using two different definitions of capitalism on the outset in his book. He was sometimes talking about voluntary exchange. At other times, he was talking about protectionism or mercantilism and decrying all of the issues and problems that arise from that, yet using the same term for both. And so all of the somewhat legitimate complaints that he raises are actually about protectionism and mercantilism and not about free exchange.
And to add on to that, a common argument or common criticism of, I'd say today's ANCOMs, like Peter Joseph types, is to say that capitalism requires government to protect private property. And my response to that is, so you have this government that does nothing but aggress against private property, and it's there to protect private property? It's a complete non sequitur. It makes no sense. How could an organization supposedly designed to protect private property do nothing but aggress against it? It's like, let's hire a carjacker to steal all the cars.
To protect us from stolen cars.
To protect us from, stealing cars. Do they not see the insanity? I don't know.
Yeah, or it's like the mob deal, you know, like, hey, you pay us, 10%, or we bust your kneecaps and protect you from someone who might steal, more than us.
Yeah.
Who might steal 15% from you.
Right.
On that level, I can sort of see a kernel of an argument, like, hey, we're not going to steal from you as bad, and we'll protect you from people who will steal more. But at that point, it's very arbitrary, right? It's seen versus unseen. Like, until you get robbed by someone else, you don't know how much they're going to rob you for. So how are you ever going to know that you're getting a good protection deal or not?
And let's not even point out the fact, and this is a pragmatic argument, but, like, I don't even know the numbers, and it's impossible to know. But I would wager that it's somewhere in the 98 to 99% of all theft is done in the public sphere, is done by government, is done lawfully, not done privately. For every time you've been robbed in a home invasion or stuck up or mugged on the street, how many times have you been forced to pay taxes? How many times have you bought something at a grocery store and they've taken away a chunk to give to government? You are robbed constantly. 99, I'd say it's probably more like 99.99%. It's just constant theft by the government, and yet private theft, which I would argue is almost inconsequential. So there's this huge fear of anarchy. Like, what would we do without government? Well, we wouldn't be getting stolen from all the time. You might get stolen from one guy. Yeah, not nearly as much. I'll take my chances, man. The odds
like
that
without, without government, who would murder all the people?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Because we need all that theft. We need all that murder. Clearly. And like Spooner says, you know, the highwayman will rob you like once, and you'll never have to see him again. And he doesn't demand that you bow down and scrape and call him sir and expect you to honor him as he's doing it. But that's what government does.
Yeah, Spooner's great. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, one other character I wanted to mention was Ragnar Danskold. I think that's how you say his name from Atlas, because he was also going around stealing from the government. And
oh,
he was
yeah.
making the argument
the
that
pirate.
It wasn't properly owned. Yeah, he was a pirate, so he was saying that it wasn't properly owned by government. Therefore, he was just liberating it from the unrightful owner. And I think he was depositing the funds in some kind of bank in the Gulf Gulch, right? Didn't they all have some kind of an account built for them that he was depositing funds to all the people who were being liberated from that dystopian nightmare of, you know, Atlas Shrugged, the whole life that was going on outside of Gulf Gulch. That sound familiar
yeah.
to you?
And there was also, if you recall, some, I mean, it wasn't just, you know, I don't think Rand was necessarily advocating that. She was playing around with that concept because actually Ragnar, he has a whole bunch of money, gold, to give to Hank when Hank shows mm-hmm. up in Gulf Gulch. And Hank's like, I don't want it. So I don't know exactly what her ultimate position is.
Yeah, yeah, she's bringing it in as an argument, but
yeah,
there were people, yeah, questioning whether it was legitimate or not. But I think it was an interesting one to bring about, just like you did with the V is her vendetta, and
mm-hmm.
whether something that's a stolen good being removed from the person or group that stole it, whether that's legitimate or not.
Right. It's an interesting question. And it, yeah, like you said, government completely muddies the waters. It's just in a free society, we would know. But in a government society, it's very murky, and arguments can be made on both sides. I tend to side with the those against government in all things, just like. But it's an interesting concept, and yeah, when I read that part, I was kind of interested to see that Hank's reaction was, "No, I don't want it." But I think other people did take it.
Yeah, I think that sounds right. I haven't seen or read that part in a while. But yeah, I think Hank was more of a, I'm going to make it on my own. And I trust in myself to be able to create value for others. Therefore, I don't need, you know, this returned to me. You know what I mean? Like Hank
uh-huh.
was like a self-made man.
He absolutely was. And so was Dagny. Dagny was, when she was offered like other businesses to run and whatnot, she's like, what are you talking about? I'm not a looter. What are you giving me this thing for? Do it on my
yeah.
own.
Yeah, and so in a way, you know, they'd already written off what had been stolen from them, so the return of it was inconsequential to them. It was like, no, I don't need that. They already stole it. Like, I'm over that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's worth noting that, yeah, Rand was not an anarchist. She is what is called a objectivist. She thinks that government should provide, or if there is going to be a government, then its only purpose is to provide for essentially a common defense. Maybe some other thing?
And adjudication.
Was it like roads and that sort of thing, or was it?
Yeah, she wanted it to enforce the laws and also, yeah, the common defense. But she was saying that there needs to be a final arbiter in any dispute, because otherwise, you know, if your court and my court disagree, then it resorts to violence. She failed to see that you could take it up another notch or two. They are, if these two courts dispute, they already have prearranged agreements on how to settle those disputes. And the groups that have, you know, the firms that have the best solution for that will rise to the top through free market processes. She sort of discounts that and thinks that government, who oftentimes create the laws, enforce the laws, and decide whether they're enforcing them correctly, somehow that's a balance of power when it's government deciding if government has done what government says it can or cannot do.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to be a pretty one-sided situation in my mind.
And the anarchist Dave Smith, he has a podcast called Part of the Problem. He was having an argument with an objectivist where the objectivist at the beginning of the argument said, I'm going to convince you to be that we need a limited government. And Smith was like, okay, this is a perfect kind of discussion I love. Let's do it. And one of the arguments that Smith the person he was with had that the objectivist didn't really have an answer for was if you're for a government, you are essentially for ultimately one world government, because the interplay of multiple governments interacting is anarchy. It is, there is no final arbiter. So you're essentially arguing for one world government, and the objectivist response didn't really have much of an answer for that. So,
and yeah, I think I've heard that argument out of Block before.
Yeah.
On a certain level, if you rely on government for a uniform standard of laws, which, you know, even that doesn't exist, right? There's 80,000 pages of different regulations and rules, and there's state level, county, city, whatever, and they often conflict, and, you know, you're probably committing a dozen felonies a day. Like,
yep.
These are the people arguing that we need a uniform set of rules that everyone lives by. Yet, even the current situation is so muddled and so disorienting. And then bringing it up a level, you know, like, what if Canada and the U.S. have a dispute? Who resolves that? You know, that's a state of anarchy as well,
mm-hmm.
like you were saying.
Yeah. And for people that are afraid of anarchy, how do they feel about the Internet? The Internet is one huge experiment in anarchy. There are certain rules, and there are certain people that are constantly trying to put rules on it. But it's essentially all free market, baby.
Yeah, you know, that might be another discussion for another day, because we opened with how on network TV you can't say or do certain things, and there's certain repercussions that happen when you do say the wrong thing at the wrong time, even if it was 11 years ago. But now that there's this net neutrality thing where the FCC wants to be in charge and regulating things like a utility, I wonder how much of that's going to encroach into content that can be on the Internet.
Yeah, and we're already seeing massive censorship in places like China, North Korea.
Well, and Facebook and YouTube. Like, those libertarian memes were getting shut down, and now there's a, I don't know what you call them, but there's a group of YouTube police now that, you know, people who are active YouTube members.
Yeah, that's the YouTube
so
hero.
Now they can flag things and get things shut down because they disagree with them or
right.
because they apply some loosely worded standard to it.
Which is really, that is so vague. And it's completely left up to the so-called hero person to decide.
Right.
Whether or not this other person deserves to be able to get paid for their content or not.
And that's one of the things I'm starting to do is load these podcasts to YouTube. So I wonder, you know, if one of those heroes took the time to make it through the first 10 minutes of one of our shows, whether we'd get shut down and how quickly. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I've been reluctant to even try putting us onto iTunes, because of their terms of service. I feel like we'd be found to be in violation of many of them, even without actually, you know, in the spirit of their loop. But I believe their meaning, we wouldn't be in violation of anything.
Well, you did put like our first episode up on YouTube, didn't you not? And it was pulled or demonetized due to the fact that you used a few clips of Jack Black saying fucking cockass.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, they have an algorithm that goes through and listens to it and finds any copyrighted material. And then whoever, quote unquote, owns the copyright can decide whether they'll allow you to use it, because they could have said no and then we'd have to remove it. But they said you can use it so long as they get the money from any ads or any monetization of the entire video, even though it was an hour and a half podcast and the little bit we use, maybe a half dozen times, is maybe 30 seconds at most.
No, did you use more than just the fucking cockass?
There was a moment where you stepped away for maybe a minute, and so I played that whole little scene where Kyle quit the band.
Oh, okay. But still,
I could just as easily
talk about a tiny little... Tiny little part, right?
Yeah, and then they get all the monetization, which if we had used more than one source of anything, like let's say I had another clip from some other band or another movie in there, then what happens, you know? Do they split between the two entities if they both allow it, if they're going to take the monetization? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. There's some probably algorithm that maybe breaks it down by percentage. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's funny how... Well, We did 88 minutes of the content, and we would get nothing. And there's 2 minutes of their material in there that they did 15 years ago for their own reasons and own purposes. Unrelated.
Right. Completely unrelated. And they get 100% of the revenue. Yeah. It makes about as much sense.
But it is their playground, the YouTube playground. You know?
It is. It is. It's a voluntary thing. You don't have to go on it. And, in fact, with that YouTube Heroes program, a lot of people have declared the death of YouTube. And I'm all for it. As soon as you find a platform undesirable, go on to another platform, create your own platform. That's the beauty
of the
market.
Wasn't that where Steemit came from? Wasn't it a retaliation to the censorship that had been occurring on Facebook?
I'm not sure if it was necessarily Facebook, but I believe it was something like that. Maybe it was Reddit. I can't imagine there's a whole lot of Reddit censorship, but it could be. I don't know. There's some Reddit moderators, isn't there? But yeah.
This could go on and on. We should probably cut it here.
Okay.
It's been on longer than it's supposed to be.
Uh-oh.
Wife's giving me the stink eye.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, she's got a stink diaper. That's what it is. She's taking it outside. You know,
we
normally take the poopy diapers, and if the poop is solid enough, we put it actually in the potty, flush it away.
Uh-huh.
But if it's just too messy, we just throw it in the trash. The outside trash, not the inside trash.
Scorched earth. Just burn it.
Yeah, burn it. Oh, man. Hey, you know, for not knowing what we were going to talk about before the show, I think this one turned into a lot of content. I know that I say a lot of filler words and not a whole lot of, like, useful things, but I think that this turned out pretty well, and I thank you for that, Robert.
Well, I think it might be something of a product of the time in between our last podcast. I think the more time we go in between, it allows more content to build up, you know, simmering under my fury rage surface. It could be. Could be. I don't know.
Yeah, well, we'll see. So let's wrap it up, man. What do you say?
Yeah, let's call it good. Thanks for listening. It's been a fun episode of the Reed Rothbard Podcast with me, Mr. Robert Johnson, and my co-host Daniel. You can go on
ReedRothbard.com. What do we run? Yeah, ReedRothbard.com.
ReedRothbard.com. We got all kinds of books, lectures. We got this podcast there. Either you found us on Podomatic, or you found us here at ReedRothbard.com. Go there for great guy named Murray Rothbard. He's like some dead economist guy. You should check him out. You probably already know who he is if you go to a thing called ReedRothbard.com, but all kinds of lectures. And Daniel is actually working on, if you didn't know, a lecture series featuring Mr. Murray, turned into like a cartoon character. And things are looking really good. It's still early on, but things are looking really good. So hopefully we'll see that soon.
Yeah, reanimate him, you know, bring him back in a way.
Yeah.
For new generations. We were lamenting earlier that he didn't live as long as he maybe could have if he had taken care of himself a bit better. I posted to Robert, well, and to the Reed Rothbard page on Facebook, a Mises meme where he says, "You're all a bunch of socialists." And we were saying how Mises lived, you know, well into his 90s and was still, you know, very active until near the end. And, you know, Rothbard, he died 20 years ago, 21 years ago now, and he was in his 60s, I think. So I can only imagine what else he could have done had he taken better care of himself. He's a brilliant guy, and I love listening to him and reading his works. And so that's one of the reasons we started this site to begin with.
Yeah, you were actually lamenting when you were coming up with this cartoon version of him, that there wasn't a fatter model that was more representative of his actual girth. I mean, it plays nothing against his arguments. We just wanted him to live longer. That's our only point. The fact that he was fat.
Yes.
We're not ad hominem attacking the guy, saying that his arguments are bad. We're saying that we wanted him to live longer, to contribute more, and to help us destroy all these terrible arguments that these Keynesians and statists are making all the time.
Right. And he also did well more than most people do, like as far as the contributions to libertarian thought and economic thinking. Like he had a mountain of contributions already. So we're not saying,
yeah,
you know, he cut us short
didn't
at all.
Do enough.
We're just saying,
right,
we can only imagine how much more he could have done had he been around longer.
Yeah, if he had just, you know, taken to walking or exercising or and then, maybe that was time he was spending in front of the typewriter, you know, tearing apart, you know, the Communist Manifesto or something, but, you know, still, it would have been nice to have him around. And we maybe would have gotten some better recordings of him and maybe some more brilliant treatises.
Indeed, sir. Well, hey, let's do wrap this one up. So thank you guys very much. We've already thanked you, and so we thank you again. And until next time, we've been the Reed Rothbard Podcast. So peace out.
Take care,
huh,
everybody. Chipmunks.
C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the Chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot,
doot. Are you going to stop recording?
Yeah, just a moment. Oh, man. I don't know if it's even recording right now.
What?
Let's see. Where's it? Yeah, it doesn't appear to be. This could be bad. This could be bad.
Fuck.
Well,
that was one of our best episodes ever.
Let me see what happens if I pull it up. Because it never said this session is no longer being recorded, right?
Right.
Okay. I just pulled it back up. It still says recording. I think we're good.
Okay.
I'll just cut this last bit.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'll save the oh fuck and make that, you know, key.
Yes.
All right, homie. I got to go. We're screaming kids.
Okay, dude. Good job.
All right. Thanks, man.